Matt, you're the only way in the corner.
So, are we ready with manning the camera? You're.
That
one. Oh. Oh. All right.
Oh, okay, there's the red light.
Okay.
If there's a rush before I leave, can you make sure that nobody tips over the camera? It should be okay. No, yes, I have something to fire on, so.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we should start before any more people come. I'm super excited to finally, after 2.5 years, to have Paul Debevec come and give a talk. Paul is a rare breed of a person who is kind of a Renaissance man. He's both a filmmaker and a very famous computer graphics researcher. Paul has got his PhD from UC Berkeley in 1996, and he went on to, and during his PhD he developed a system called Passat, which was basically the first image-based rendering system, and it's super highly cited, and the research developed there went on to be used in movies, mainly The Matrix is the big example of those tools being used. Paul has moved on to, he's now the Associate Director for the Graphics Research and Executive Producer, I believe, at the Institute for Creative Technologies at the University of Southern California. And he is also an Associate Research Professor at USC's Computer Science Department. He has also produced his own movies, his own short films that were shown in and a variety of festivals, and I hope you will show some bits of that. Paul has gotten the SIGGRAPH Significant Young Researcher Award in 2001. This is basically the biggest deal in computer graphics. Any other things that Paul has? And Paul has been the chair of the SIGGRAPH 2007 Computer Animation Festival, which is, again, a very, very fancy, schmancy position. So we're super happy to have Paul come here, and especially for Paul, I'm told that the Robograds are organizing a post-seminar reception after this at 5 o'clock over in the other room. So we're very happy to have Paul. Please.
Thank you, Alyosha. Dynamic range, not a bad thing. Right. A little light is probably good.
And Alyosha also asked if I could show at least some clips from some of the movies that I've been involved with. So these are some of the older ones here that I'll show quickly some clips. This is a image here of the Berkeley campus, and I was interested in trying to do very photoreal computer graphics. This is before I really understood exactly how radiosity and global illumination work. So if I was going to do anything, I had to sort of steal the results from other places, and the idea was to use photographs, which already look realistic, and then somehow turn photographs into the photoreal computer-generated models that we'll see. And that was actually a computer-generated rendering. It was created by actually taking photographs of the tower and campus from a kite, and this is Professor Charles Benton, who's now the chair of the architecture department at Berkeley, who helped us take pictures from his kite. This is a little bit of a run that we did, which wasn't so successful, getting the camera in the air. Oh, and I realize I can actually turn on my microphone. Maybe I'll compete with the speakers there. Is that a lot better? Great. Yeah. Okay, cool. So there we are shooting that. These are the pictures we got. Some from the ground and some from the kite. And then I actually climbed up on the top of the tower. This was really the most fun part of the project. And took some pictures of the campus surrounding there. Not very many pictures, so when you're actually the person holding the camera, you can be very specific and deliberate about what you're capturing. So just kind of looking around in a circle. And for that, with the facade system that I developed with C.J. Taylor, we constructed all of that geometry for the campus. And it's pretty simple geometry when you look at it, very prismatic. It uses some advanced forms of photogrammetry based on line correspondences and modeling was seen as polyhedral primitives, so you can figure out all of the shapes with the minimum amount of correspondences to the images. And then once you texture map it, everything looks a lot more realistic. And we took advantage of this to the hill to do some of the renderings that we did. And I had a chance to actually make a short film that we showed at the SIGGRAPH conference that used this. And we'll see just a quick clip. It looks kind of like this, but in the film we did some transitions back to reality from some real footage shot on campus. And that allowed doing a couple of interesting transitions. So I think this is from the film here. And if you kind of match the viewpoints up, you can do a couple of cute things like that. And go back. And the other cool thing about this is we could actually render this imagery in real time. Even back then, we had a silicon graphics machine that had enough texture memory we could do it for realistically. Now the music that's coming in the background is actually foreshadowing the fact that this is one of the technologies that got used to make the bullet time shots in The Matrix, and one of the master's students I had a chance to supervise as a postdoc went over there after the visual effects supervisor for the film had seen this movie at SIGGRAPH 97 and thought it would be a good solution for generating the computer-generated backgrounds to look realistic enough behind the action in the various bullet time shots. So if you take a look at these are the photographs they took on top of their building, and from them they reconstructed the basic version of the scene. So this is a computer-generated camera move behind them of a virtual version of the scene. And the foreground had to be shot in studio conditions because they needed to do this time slice rig here and implement that kind of technique. And then they needed to drop in a background behind it that was just as realistic as the real background that you see in the shots right before the bullet time shot and the real background that you see right after the bullet time shot. So using this image-based modeling and rendering technique was an attractive way for them to be able to match everything up together that way. So another piece of work that I had a chance to work on at Berkeley was some work in the area of image-based lighting. Was the idea of trying to illuminate computer-generated objects with the light of scenes that was actually there. And I had a chance to work with some Berkeley students and some of my colleagues to make another film called Fiat Lux that takes place in St. Peter's Basilica. And the idea is that we would create an image-based model of the interior of St. Peter's Basilica, but then instead of just flying around it like we did in the Campanile movie, we add some new objects to it so it looks like we're actually able to kind of create a computer animation that has some more interesting stuff going on. And to record the illumination, I actually realized, because I wanted these new objects, there's going to be these big falling over dominoes in here.
I wanted it to look like they're really lit by the light that was there, casting shadows in the right directions, having the right highlights. And I worked with Jitendra on a technique for assembling high dynamic range images from a series of differently exposed photographs. And this is one of those series that I took during the time I had to take pictures in St. Peter's. I also shot panoramic images, so I could have these panoramas I could pan across that had the full dynamic range of the light in the scene. We can't really display it on the computer here, the video projector, but it actually knows how bright the light is coming from that window and coming from these light sources up in the vaulting. I'm running kind of a blur filter on it to sort of emphasize that illumination, and that shows off the high dynamic range. It's sort of one way of doing a tone mapping for that. And to put some three-dimensional motion in the camera move, I constructed a model of the interior of St. Peter's from that panorama and facade. And that's basically the extent of the complexity of that model. Pretty simple. And then we used the dynamic simulation package to simulate the animation we wanted to put in there. And I also had a number of these light probe images, basically these high dynamic range environment maps that recorded the light at different points going along the nave and going around the altar of the basilica, so we could illuminate the objects with this omnidirectional measurement of light that comes from around the data. So this is actually a shot from the film here, where we've added some things to the scene that weren't really there. I'll just show the second half of the film, so that shot will play again. This is a very different kind of a lighting environment in the Galleria degli Uffizi. We'll see this lighting environment show up a couple more times during the talk. The whole film is sort of about the conflict between Galileo and the church, so in a very abstract sense, so that's kind of like a lens in one of his telescopes floating around in there. So this is from one panorama that I took at the beginning of the nave of the basilica. And I showed up there with my tripods and mirrored spheres, and they kind of looked at me a little funny, and it was only after a considerable amount of negotiation that they let me have 60 minutes to shoot everything I wanted to. So I had to go fast shooting all of these high dynamic range images to get the stuff for the film. And we didn't have to do any manual effort to decide how these things should be lit. They're just literally lit with the light that was actually there. It's a certain kind of lighting, it has a certain kind of feel. And hopefully it looks consistent with these objects that are rendered into the backgrounds. Now this got us inspired to actually try to push the techniques a little bit further and start to look at not just rendering computer-generated objects into these backgrounds, but to render images of real people into these backgrounds. If you're trying to make a film, it probably shouldn't only be about monoliths falling on top of each other, but actual human characters that can act out a scene and things like that, like you have in normal movies. So we got interested in, this is essentially been a continuing research area until this day, because human faces are so rich and interesting in order to make renderings of. The first technique that we were able to try to take advantage of is something based on the superposition principle of light. There's a nice example on Paul Kaberly's Graphica Obscura website that does essentially what you're going to see here. But you have this nice effect, which is if you have an image of a face that's lit from two lighting directions at the same time. This is Wesley, who's actually our animator for the Fiat Lux film, Wesley Sorokin. He's lit with a spotlight on the right and a spotlight on the left, and he kind of looks like he's lit from both sides at the same time. That's good. We also took photographs of him lit from each lighting condition. This is from a time when I liked Enya more than I do now, so it's Enya in this one. This is photographs of him lit from the left and the right individually, and then the magic of the linear superposition principles of light is if you add these two images together, RGB value to RGB value, it actually reproduces his appearance under both light source directions at the same time. And even better, you can actually tint the images a little bit, or brighten one up versus the other, before you add them together, and then it produces images of him lit with lighting that he was never lit by, like having kind of a purple light from one direction and white light from the other direction. Or you can make it, red light from one direction and blue light from another direction. So at this point, it looked like we had control over illuminating Wesley any way that we wanted to. We could do any color and intensity of light as long as it came from just those two directions. We thought if we want to light him with the light of St. Peter's Basilica or the Uffizi Gallery or any of the other lighting environments that we might want to do, then we were almost there. It's just that we need to make it so that we can change the color intensity of light from any direction, all at the same time. Because when you're standing out in the lighting environment, you've got a different color and intensity of light coming from every direction. It all sums up and produces your appearance. Whenever you look at something, if it's not black, there's light coming from it, and that's part of the illumination that's determining how you reflect light back. So we thought for a while, how can we build a device that will allow us to photograph a person lit from all the different directions that light can come from? And we eventually, after enough trips to Home Depot, came up with the following contraption, which consisted of a 250-watt spotlight there. It's pulled by ropes here. This is Chris Chu and Tim Hawkins on our project. This is one of our other undergrads, HP, sitting in the chair there. And we're filming him with a mini DV camera. And we pulled the ropes in such a way that after the course of about a minute, we were able to capture basically 1,800 images of his face, all lit from every direction light can come from on the sphere. So we have this database of how he looks from all these different directions, from the front, you know, from the right, left, top, bottom, even all the directions when he's lit from behind, because those are actually relatively important directions because you get kind of these nice bright ring light effects around there. Cinematographers are always putting lights just off camera to make their movie stars sort of pop off of the background a little bit with rim lighting. So we get those kinds of effects over here. And now at this point, we'd like to show his face lit with one of our light probe images here. This is one taken in Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. It's kind of a nice one because it sort of has warm light coming from the altar and cool colors of light coming from the stained glass window and different colors of kind of gray and purplish and brown light for the indirect illumination coming from other directions. And essentially, if you sample this image into the same sampling that you have of the database of facial images, we can actually multiply these two data sets together. And that has a useful effect. So let's watch that. Alrighty then. So by modulating these two data sets, and actually just for purpose of the video, we're slowly rotating the lighting environment around so everything's kind of animated. But what's happened is that these images of the face are bright and yellow because there's supposed to be bright yellow light coming from that direction. So those images of the face lit from that direction are now receiving that illumination. And these became bright and sort of these coolish, slightly purple colors because that's the light from the stained glass windows. This is the light from the door at the end of the nave that has some kind of bright daylight coming from it. And then all of these other images are the colors of the indirect light in the environment. And then one more time, since light is additive, if we want to show him lit by the entire environment at once, we just have to add it all together. And there we go. So there's our undergrad there, who's illuminated by the light of Grace Cathedral. And you can see he kind of gets this orange rim light around him because that's where that orange light is coming from. And you can see the light from the stained glass windows reflecting in his forehead and in his hair and all of the other indirect illumination on him. And the cool thing about this is that it's a very fast and efficient technique. It makes no knowledge of 3D geometry. It's just all adding images together. And it's magically simulating, you know, the diffuse reflection of the skin, the specular reflection, the inter-reflections, the self-shadowing, the subsurface scattering, anisotropic reflections of the hair. It's just all simulated there, right, because all of those phenomena are shown one lighting condition at a time in the original imagery, and physics just lets us add these things together and we get the right result. It's very efficient to do. You can even do this on JPEG compressed versions of the images, which we use to make an online demo that relights faces in real time. But if we want to show them in a different lighting environment, like the light of that we used for one of our other films, Rendering with Natural Light, we can easily just go to a different illumination environment like this. So that was actually the last project that we did at UC Berkeley. It was a SIGGRAPH 2000 paper. When I got down to the University of Southern California in the Los Angeles area, one of the first things that the heads of the institute said is, well, it'd be great if you had that light stage thing running again by the time we open our institute, which was like about 3 months from when I actually showed up there and they had the grand opening event. So we had to kind of scramble and figure out, well, let's see if we can not just, you know, build that thing again, because we'd sort of taken it apart and it was stored some random place in Berkeley's computer science building. It may still be there to this day, I don't know. But we thought, how can we build a better light stage? Well, it seemed like it would be better if it were faster for capturing these kinds of data sets. To do that, we designed one that still had moving parts, but it had a whole semicircle of illumination conditions, of different strobe lights, actually. So it looks something like this. And in this way here, in about a course of 8 seconds or so, you get a data set of about 480 images of the face looking in different directions. And this is Jonathan Cohen, who worked with us at the time, kind of demonstrating what it's like to sit in there and get lit by the light stage. So this is right after we built it. We realized there were a couple things that needed to be cleaned up. We ended up replacing the strobe lights, making the arm a little bit more circular, and painting the room black. That helps out a lot. But this was at least cool to look at, which is really all that management needed for us to open the So we did have a chance to actually use LightStage 2 in some of our research projects. And one of the cool things about working in the Los Angeles area is that we have the opportunity, and actually our institute's charter encourages us, to collaborate with the entertainment industry. So one of the first things that we got to do to actually use LightStage 2 was with Sony Pictures Imageworks when they were doing the visual effects for the movie Spider-Man 2. And they knew they needed to do some digital stunt doubles, and they wanted these digital stunt doubles to look as realistic as possible. And I'm going to get right on to that. This is the movie where there's the guy with the big metal arms named Doc Ock. He's played by Alfred Molina. And they brought the fellow over there so that we could essentially use light stage data sets to scan the reflectance properties of his face. Now, the little video resolution video cameras that we've been using were not sufficient for their purposes. So they actually brought in these film cameras, these 35 millimeter Aeroflex film cameras, they ran at 60 frames per second, which is over-cranking them from the standard 24 frames per second that film is. And we synchronized our strobes to them, and we shot these data sets. They had four cameras, so they got the face from the front, the two sides, and from below, so they covered all the facial surfaces. And essentially what they then did, since the digital actor needed to be seen from different directions than the original cameras shot them from, and also in different facial expressions, because he's actually acting. In the stunt scene, he's mostly grunting and yelling at people and things like that, but that's significant facial motion there. What they did is they had a cyberware scan of Alfred Molina's face, and they projected these images on using image-based rendering techniques to basically become relightable texture maps for the face. So this is a rendering that we can see of Alfred Molina's face here, the digital Doc Ock character. It's a completely computer-generated image here. All of the skin is reflecting light according to the illumination that we captured in the light stage. So it's using kind of a blended together version of the left views and the front view and the underneath view to texture map those surfaces there. And it's being viewed from a new position because it's projected onto geometry and then reprojected into a new position. His hair actually wasn't the right kind of orangish color that this comic book character has when we scanned him. So that's actually digital hair on top of him. And in fact, they also scanned him without sunglasses, and they're digitally rendering CG sunglasses on there. One of the nice things that Sony did is they made it so that these image-based reflectance data sets can actually photometrically interact with a traditional CG object, like the digital clothing of his digital body or the glasses that cast shadows on there. What, once again, we have the ability to light this whatever the needs of the scene are going to be. So if he's moving through the scene, the illumination can actually change on him. These are just tests that were done in a couple of different illumination environments with some sort of whitish illumination and kind of in this alleyway illumination. And in the end, they actually used this technique to render the digital skin of Doc Ock in about 40 shots in the film. So see, these are a couple of the key shots that are the fully digital Doc Ock. So in this case here, he's actually carrying Kirsten Dunst up a building here. He's all digital. He actually looks a little bit more real than she does in the shot, because she was just a live action plate that was composited in there. So even though she was real, she wasn't lit right for what it was supposed to be. And he was, because they had as much control as they wanted to over how to light him. And they actually did film him without his shirt on, the poor fellow, so that, you know, they could get all the way down to his belt with the image base for Fleckman's properties. And there he is kind of, you know, yelling down from a tower. This is his death scene. They decided to use the digital version because he's supposedly falling back underwater, and they didn't want to have the real actor be underwater and acting like he's dead, floating back, because there's a safety issue there. So they did that. And actually, when we shot him, they actually also brought in Tobey Maguire, who plays Spider-Man. And we weren't exactly sure why they needed that, because usually when he's up to his stunt kinds of things, he's Spider-Man and he's wearing a mask. So we found out, actually, when we finally saw the film, why they were doing it, because there is a scene where he's to stop a train and his mask is he had to take off. So these are some of the late stage data sets that got used for him as well. We've gotten to work on a couple of other films on that. One that's a little bit more recent that came out pretty well was when we scanned this fellow here, named Brandon Routh, and he was the fellow chosen to be the new Superman. So they brought him back after his Thanksgiving break, and he got scanned in a couple of different positions there. For this one, they actually brought his whole Superman suit as well, and I wish I'd been able to take a photograph of it. The suit has not been fully approved yet. I'm not sure what that means, but it hasn't been. And so I couldn't take pictures of that. But if you just imagine that guy like in the Superman suit with all the plates, then that's pretty cool. I should mention, by the way, it looks like we have lights everywhere. It's really just that spinning semicircular arm going around, and I took a long exposure photograph of the camera, so it makes it look like all the lights are there. But it really is just that one semicircle. And that was used for the digital Superman face. So this is one case here where he has to help the space shuttle out by kind of tossing it into a nice safe orbit trajectory. He's out in space, and that's his digital face reflecting there. They have a bit of an animated model, so they can pose his eyes to a new position, and they can actually make him go into different facial expressions. Superman is a relatively stoic fellow, so they didn't need a lot of acting out of him for these. That certainly played to the advantage of the realism of the technique. And they were also able to use basically some of the late stage data for the cape and the outfit as reflectance data for the digital suit that they made, which is, you know, a very ornate, expensive piece of costumery. I think there's actually like tiny little S's on every one of these little bumps you can see here. So the reflectance that they had was helpful. There's a whole scene at the end of the movie where he's all digital, he flies close to camera. Things worked out pretty well for him as a result, so he's relatively satisfied at this point, so they kind of animated a little bit kind of a satisfied expression on his face. I guess they're kind of doing his job for him as an actor, which I don't know how he really felt about that, but he was probably excited to get to be Superman in any case. Actually, a lot of the shots of him were originally shot on green screen of the real guy, and they could have used those elements, but they decided not to, and they used their digital Superman to essentially replace that footage. And the reason for that is that, you know, when you shoot a real guy on a real green screen, you sort of have to commit to a certain lighting condition. The cinematographer does their best to try to guess what the right ratio of key to fill is that's going to make him look good in the scene, and then they also have to try to get him just the right angle and performance and all of that. It gets complicated. And they didn't always get that right, and they didn't like the look of the real element in there, so they just said, well, let's just take the digital guy and kind of make him do the same thing, but get the right expression on his face this time, or the right angle, or the right lighting, and then they put it in there. And I don't think they even pulled the director on a lot of this. So there's some shots in there that weren't planned via visual effects. There's one shot where they had really high resolution data of the face, where Superman is flying out into space and he has to think really hard about something. So the camera dramatizes this by kind of zooming right in on kind of where he's doing the thing in this area. So this is really like the whole film frame from top to bottom. And since it's image-based data, you get, you know, some really nice kinds of effects. There's clearly, you know, some interesting effects of multi-layer subsurface scattering and a little bit of the fuzz that you get on skin and things like that. And those are things that are, you know, still relatively difficult to simulate these days. And there are no known great acquisition techniques for those kinds of properties at this point. So if you can just capture it with images and then have their lighting artist be able to decide that, you know, he's being lit by, I don't know, moonlight from this direction and I don't know what kind of light from this direction and other light from this direction that makes it look pretty and tells the scene, then you've created a tool that's actually useful for the people who are trying to tell the story. So that's a, an exciting thing there. One of the nice things about getting to work with collaborators in general, including folks in the entertainment industry, is it often gives you ideas for, you know, what really could help them out next and what would be a good direction for the research to go. And one thing that we're realizing is a limitation of all of these techniques is that you're essentially capturing people in static poses and then kind of animating the face around so that it looks like they're acting. And it might be nice to actually really record the performance of the actor. So the idea of putting an actor in a light stage and literally recording their performance under all these different lighting conditions means that you'd have to shoot a data set that ends up looking something like this. You'd have to have somebody preparing, you know, doing their motion, but getting them in, you know, a couple hundred lighting conditions simultaneously. Well, you could do that by just lighting them from one direction, having them do the performance, and then redo the performance 150 times. They probably wouldn't line up with themselves quite exactly. So that didn't seem too practical. And what we realized is if we wanted to capture this kind of data set, we'd have to capture all those lighting conditions interleaved with each other and very rapidly change the illumination direction. So we had to build another light stage, and we had to do one that didn't have moving parts this time. So this image that you see here actually is not a long exposure. It's just a regular photograph of what we're calling actually a light stage 5. At this point, we had a couple of mishaps, and this is number 5. And this is actually a 2-meter sphere with 156 LED light sources. LEDs have gotten very bright in recent years, so it made this kind of idea possible. And they're controlled by a microcontroller, so we have no problem changing the lighting condition on our actor at thousands of times per second. With 156 light sources, and if we say we want to get a light stage data set every 24th of a second, so we have one for every frame of film that's going to go out, then you're actually going to need something on the order of, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 frames per second. No problem making the LEDs change that quickly. How are you going to film it? Well, we're very lucky that people have invented high-speed cameras that can actually film at those rates. And this is one from Vision Research, a Phantom V7 camera. It's 800 by 600 resolution, so not too bad for that. And it will actually film at 4,800 frames per second, so plenty of frames per second for that. It has pretty big pixels, so it's very sensitive to light. That helps us out a lot. And the way that it actually records so fast is that it doesn't even try to save it to disk or tape or anything like that, but it actually has 8 gigabytes of RAM chips inside the camera body, and it just puts them on there. And once you get a tape that you like, then you can just download it off of the camera. So filming at the lighting resolutions that we had, we were able to record for about 5 or 6 seconds. They have larger storage solutions here. It might not seem like 5 or 6 seconds is a long time to record for, but if you saw, for example, the movie The Bourne Ultimatum that came out this summer, the average shot length in that film was a new record low of just under 2 seconds per shot in the film. So we might have been able to shoot that movie. The previous record was Michael Bay's over Armageddon, which was just over 2 seconds per shot. But the result was that we could actually then, using this image-based relighting technique, take, this is Marissa, she's a theater student at USC, take her performance and relight it to look like we wanted it in any lighting conditions that we wanted to see. So this is exactly the same performance. Here she is lit with the light of Grace Cathedral. We're just scaling the colors and intensities of all of these basis images and then summing them all together. Here she is in the light of the Uffizi Gallery, where all of those large dominoes were falling over. And then this is actually her lit by the light of just some random environment I drew in Photoshop, which didn't end up being terribly attractive lighting, but serves the point that it really can be anything. So I just kind of made a blob of some sort of greenish sort of thing. So at this point here, you might be able to turn this tool over to like a real cinematographer who could actually, you know, paint different colors in there, watch the performance, and you get the thought that maybe, you know, in films of the future, while they're actually editing the film, they could get an idea for, you know, wouldn't it be nice if the lighting were just a little different in the scene, or if there was, you know, a little bit more rim lighting or a little bit more fill accentuating that part of the actor's performance, or a little bit more light from below to kind of accentuate, you know, how evil they're looking in a spooky movie or something. And they could actually turn these lights around, and for every single shot of the film, have the lighting be as optimal as possible, even with all of the hindsight and retrospect once you see it edited into the piece. So that might be a way that this technology could help people better realize their creative visions. It also might help them shoot movies more quickly, because if you don't have to bother with all the lighting on set, which is apparently about half the time spent on set is fiddling with lights, setting them up, and making sure that it looks right on the actor once the stand-in goes back to the trailer, you could possibly even save money with it as well. So we were really excited with these results. The thing that obviously it doesn't really solve is now we're kind of back to a fixed viewpoint on the face. So we'd like to be able to move the camera around anywhere. And this, like our other light stages, was pretty much just looking at the head and shoulders of a subject. We kind of calculated that the working range of this light stage was about, you know, 50 centimeters over which those lights evenly focused. So we had the idea, well, let's try to solve both of these problems and do a project where we're actually able to change the viewpoint on the performance in post-production, as well as the illumination. And then also capture the whole human body. So that meant taking our 50 centimeter working volume to maybe, say, a 2 meter working volume. And that meant, if we're just scaling everything up, taking our 50 centimeter, our 2 meter light stage, all the way up to an 8 meter light stage. And we did a little bit of models in Maya for that. We came up with something funny that looked like this. It's basically scaling things up there. We wrote up like a little 3-page summary of what it would be like to build one of these things, and we made sure that, you know, the management of our institute was aware of this exciting possibility before them. At one point, they had to relocate one of their off-site virtual reality projects to a different space. They wanted to go from about 1,500 square feet of space to maybe around 3,000 square feet of space. And they ended up finding a building that was about 4,500 square feet of space, and it was a little bit larger than they thought they really needed, and that, you know, the various sponsors of the projects thought was good to spend on that. So they had this thought, well, why don't you make it a multi-project facility? And all of a sudden, I'm approached at this sort of white paper we had about building this big light stage, which we hadn't taken too terribly seriously at the time. It's like, hey, you know what? It'd be really great if you could build that, because then we can actually get this other space for this other project. And so we spent a couple of months thinking about what it would take to actually build it, figuring out the design of the lights and the controllers and all of that, finding a way to do it cheaply enough we could do it in our existing funds for the year. And then after two pretty active months of putting things together, we had built light stage 6. So this is actually a photograph of it. It's about a mile away from our institute, actually in the former site of the building of House of Moves motion capture studio. So it's definitely a place that's appropriate for shooting this kind of data. It has, for light stage 6, it actually has, it turned out by coincidence, I only found this out a couple months ago, it actually has 6,666 LEDs on it, which is hopefully not a bad sign. But they're arranged in groups of 6, and there's about 1,000 on the dome and about 200 lighting positions here on the ground. And the ones on the ground are actually just kind of bare LEDs with corner reflectors reflecting it toward the subject. So those essentially keep the same Lambertian emission as like a ground plane that can get close to a person would radiometrically simulate, and then the whole rest of the dome is trying to simulate being infinitely far away. And we've used this, we've taken a couple of commercial data sets with this, and we've got one publication out so far that actually uses this to try to capture human locomotion, like walking and running, in a relightable form. And for that, we built this treadmill in there that's actually on a turntable that we can turn around. And if all goes well, I can play a video of that. So this is Bruce here from our laboratory, walking around in light stage 6. So it looks like he's concentrating a little bit. He is. We started with kind of an off-the-shelf surplus or discontinued model treadmill from the local sporting goods store, and then hacked off the whole dashboard area of it. So normally you have something to hold on to and some visual reference. We did our best to disguise all of that and put it on an otherwise completely same colored surface down here. So he's actually paying attention to some grooves that we cut underneath the treadmill belt so he can feel where he is left and right, and there's a little bit of a bump in the middle forward back. So this is about take 25 that we're doing here. Here is our high-speed camera again, and for this we were actually able to borrow two more high-speed cameras from the company because they wanted to help us out a little bit. So we have not just a chest level camera, but we have one at ground level, and we have one about a meter and a half above this one as well, so you know, about half a meter above the head. And Bruce, after he had walked, he was able to run. We've synchronized everything to kind of his natural walking rhythm and running rhythm. For this. And this would actually only take 5 of him doing the run cycle at this point. And it's lit so far that like all these lights just kind of stay on and they're, you know, just keeping him well lit. But if we slow down the footage, you'll actually be able to see sort of the time multiplex nature of the illumination that we're putting on him. So we slow everything down. And those are all the lighting conditions. So that's kind of a back right light. That's down from the ground. That's kind of from front, maybe from the ground, maybe from the stage. There's another lighting condition. And they're all multiplexed in.
So you're turning a whole bunch of them at the same time?
Yes. And in this case here, we're basically doing like banks of about 30 lights. So we have about 30 different lighting conditions in our bases. Depending on what resolution we want to choose and how many images we want to shoot, we can either make it down to, you know, just a group of 4 lights or, you know, a larger bank like this. In this case here, you're going to see we had to capture 36 consecutive walk cycles. So in order to fit the data in the memory, we had to cut down on our lighting resolution a little bit. So if we then look at the images that we get in a 30th of a second, it's not quite as extensive as we had before, but we've got these 30 different lighting conditions. Bruce actually, in this 30th of a second, moves a little bit from this position to this position. So he actually runs some optical flow between different images in the sequence and kind of line them all up, make them look like they were all shot at the same time. That's actually based on these tracking frames that happen every 11 frames. So we run optical flow from here to here, and here to here. We assume the motion is linear across this 90th of a second, and then it pretty much keeps things on top of each other there. Now what we did is that the turntable is slowly rotating around so that by the time he's taken 36 walk cycles, he's gone 360 degrees. So we actually have him not just in all lighting conditions and from an array of vertical positions, but we have him effectively from an array of horizontal positions as well. So you're going to see him do a little twirl here. That's by kind of skipping forward one walk cycle in the sequence. And you can see we get all the way around there. So if we take a look at all of these different views here, we essentially have a 3x36 camera array filming his performance, and we're taking advantage of the repetitive nature of this performance that we get all of those views and we can pretend that we have many more high-speed cameras than we really do. Now another thing is we wanted to take him out of this scene and put him into another scene. One way that we did that is by getting a transparency map for him. So one of our lighting conditions turns off all the lights on Bruce and then just lights this white paper behind him, or gray paper behind him, so we get a really nice matte. That's exactly what you want if you're going to be doing some compositing. That didn't work for his feet, so we actually put retro-reflective cloth on the treadmill belt and the turntable, and then light that from the position of the camera. And then that lights up too when we shoot those map frames and we get a map for his whole body. So using the data that we have in the maps, it's easy to get rid of the background and then decide that we're going to light him with any lighting condition that we want. So we can spin a spotlight around him, or light him with the light of the Grace of Dave Lopes, because we like that a lot. Or put him in the pizza gallery. And that changes the illumination on and can walk along. What we also need to do is then change the viewpoint. And for that, we're going to use a combination of view interpolation, a la Steve Seitz 1996, and light field rendering, a la LeVoy and Hanrahan, Fort Lauderdale 1996. Where basically we're saying that we have a camera array of all of these, kind of a lowly sampled light field. And then what we'll do is we'll use optical flow between these different viewpoints here so that we can actually generate intermediate views anywhere along here or anywhere along here. Or if we do quadrilinear interpolation, we can generate any intermediate view in this area here. And Charles Felix Chabert in our group actually wrote this in as a pixel shader. So we can, in real time, this is actually a live screen capture, actually displace and morph all of these images to make it seem like it's an infinitely highly sampled light field, and then do light field rendering to be able to start from far away, move in, have the perspective shifts occur, and then orbit around the performance in this case. And if you're watching closely, his position kind of shifts around a little bit, because it's actually blending between different walk cycles, and he doesn't exactly repeat his motion. Fortunately, once we animate this and he's in motion, you don't tend to see those transitions anymore. So let's get down to what we were hoping to do. The idea is that maybe we've gone out and we've shot one of these high-res light probe images, and we've done one of these like hands across like we did in St. Peter's Basilica, but instead of dominoes going down there, we want to put Bruce, for example. So the hope is, let's light Bruce so that he's lit with the light of that environment, and then also match his viewpoint to starting from far away from us and then running past the camera. And that should be a good test whether this stuff works. And here's our first shot with Bruce somewhere he hasn't been. So there he goes. So if I pause here for a second, hopefully it looks like he sort of picked up the general colors of the environment and the viewpoint is matched and appropriate to the camera move that we've got. This particular environment has sort of warm light coming from behind the camera. That's because there's this orange-yellowish building that's being lit by the sun. So that's producing some of this bounce light here. And then he's getting some cooler colors of illumination, you know, on the other side of folds of his shirt, which is coming from the skylight in the other direction. So hopefully it looks like he kind of belongs in that environment, and this might have been a real photograph of him actually there. Now, since he is completely virtual, we can give him some company, for example. And you can also see that we are calculating some shadows as well. This technique here is actually, you know, very, very, very image-based. There's actually no notion of Bruce's 3D shape or any BRDF fitting whatsoever that's gone into rendering Bruce here. It's just all blending between images and taking linear combinations of them. The shadow here, we actually thought of trying to pull the shadows off of the appearance of his real shadows on the treadmill, but those were a little bit messed up and our view didn't extend really far enough to do that. So we thought, well, okay, we'll try to synthesize those shadows. And so Alex Ma in our group took some of those matte images, kind of like, you know, from the front and like, you know, every 45 degrees around, intersected them to get kind of a rough volumetric shape of Bruce. And then from that rough volumetric voxel shape, I could calculate for all of these points around here how much light was blocked. And that kind of produced sort of like a cool shadow over here and a warm shadow over here as it blocks the skylight or the light from the building, respectively. And then just kind of taking this to its logical conclusion, we put lots of Bruces here. The Bruces actually aren't self-shadowing each other or inter-reflecting light between each other. That's something we should eventually at this point, but they should not be colliding with each other, so they just pass right by them. So obviously all the Bruces are doing the same thing at the same time. Bruce was certainly amused to watch this and send it to his parents back home in Scotland. We sometimes just refer to Bruces as data sets, or this data set is like we need the Bruce data set, so we have to be a little sensitive when we speak of it in that way in groupings. But the obvious limitation here is he's just running along and along. He's doing exactly the same thing. So one of the things that is of interest for future work is to do something that would be kind of like a motion graph approach or some of the things that are happening in James Kuffner's group here at the moment to kind of blend between different motions and choose between a walk and a run and other things we can get them to do in the light stage. Apply some of those techniques that kind of animate a richer amount of positions from motion capture data and apply it to an image-based data set like this. So we might be able to do some more things that way. There's a quick time-lapse movie, which it's actually running in reverse. These are the first 4 days of building the light stage here. Certainly the most fun 4 days. The wiring kind of stuff. But anyway. Cool. All right, so continuing on, I have two more things I brought to talk about. And trying to get through them. One of them is some work that is done by Alex Ma and some other members of our group. He's a PhD student from National Taiwan University, spent about 2 years with us. And we got interested in seeing if our light stage system could be used not just to get image-based data sets that have a lot of realism to their text dimensions, the texture maps are really high res, but actually as a really nice geometry acquisition device. And we were partially inspired by some great virtual character work that we'd seen that had made use of life casts of actors. So some of the other techniques that had decent looking virtual actors basically take the actor and they put goop all over their face and then pull a mold off of that and then pour plaster into the mold. And if you do that right, you can get pretty good detail down to like a tenth of a millimeter or so. And then if you send that cast up to a company like XYZ RGB in Canada, they will, for a reasonable fee for what it is, but relatively expensive, will actually scan a three-dimensional model of that and produce a life cast. And these are nice because they have a lot of great, you know, skin detail that gets pulled off of that. So we got interested if, well, on light stages, you know, we need high-res cameras there. Maybe we could scan really high-res geometric models off of our light stages. Now, one of the problems, though, is that with photometric approaches, if you're trying to scan the real actor instead of a cast of them, you have a problem with the fact that light scatters within skin. So this is I put a piece of paper on top of my hand and put a laser stripe across. You can see on the paper, the laser stripe is pretty sharp. You might be able to read reasonably high-res geometry off of that. But once it hits your skin, and it diffuses around quite a bit, you might not be able to read very high-res geometry off of that, just because skin scatters the light. So how are you really going to find out what that high-res geometry is? We'd love to have a photometric approach to getting this kind of data, because then we have a chance of actually capturing it in real time and not having to put goop on people's faces and not having to deal with the fact that the goop actually kind of deformed your face a little bit and you have to inflate it back out and such. So we thought, well, what is some photometric information that reflects off of the face that has that high resolution detail? We know that the subsurface scattering doesn't have it, but there's actually some light that hits a face that doesn't scatter within the skin and reflects back off, and that's the specular reflection of the face. Let's see here, given current trends in computer graphics, particularly here at CMU, it would be inappropriate not to have a random image found off the web in a talk. So this is one I found of actress Hilary Swank here, not a great photo of her by any means, but it shows the effect that if you're looking for this fine level detail in skin wrinkles and skin pores, you can't really see it in the diffuse reflection on your face, but you can see it near the specular reflection. And that's because this light has just gone right off the front surface. It hasn't diffused and scattered in. And if we can figure out the geometry based on that reflection versus the reflection of the subsurface light, then maybe we can actually derive this information photometrically. Yes?
It's not clear that the specular reflection does a better job than whatever's happening in her mouth to go after wrinkles.
Good point. So you're seeing some wrinkles in here, right?
And on the other side, especially.
In here, that one. So I would say those wrinkles are probably large enough that they're larger than the millimeter level. And at that point, since light scatters within the skin on the order of a millimeter or two, that you're probably okay in that case. It could also be that some of the multi-layer scattering there, that you're getting kind of the diffuse-ish reflection there, where at grazing angles it doesn't scatter, and if you're just kind of on the edge there, you might be able to pull that out. That kind of information is harder to use for relatively flat surfaces of the face, where you want to get that small detail. But it would be interesting to pull it out of that, too. These are kind of things where to really get the shape you kind of need down to a tenth of a millimeter or so. So, at this point here, if we do want to analyze it based on specular reflections, we need to somehow, it would be great if we had a way of photographing the face and only seeing the specular light reflecting off of it, and just having all the other light magically disappear. So as it turns out, you can do that. And we played around with that a little bit in one of our earlier papers with the first light stage, when we were trying to separate reflections components. And you can do that. For example, these are some photos from that project. If you have a face lit from a single light source, a view from a single camera, you can actually put polarizers on both the light source and the camera. And do it so that if you polarize the light, say, horizontally, and then place a vertical polarizer on the camera, the specular light, which is like a mirror reflection, actually gets blocked. And you'll only see the subsurface reflection. So that kind of image looks like this. And it's a really cool effect. This technique has been also used relatively recently and also historically in computer vision for some VRDF analysis. But what's even cooler is that if you want to look at just the specular, we can actually look at the difference between an unpolarized image and a polarized image and look at just the specular light. And the subsurface light goes away. Actually, the best way to do this is just polarize your light source and take two images with a camera, one polarized this way, one polarized this way, and subtract the two. Because then, when you're parallel polarized, the diffuse component is actually only coming through at about half intensity, so it's already halfway gone. The specular component tends to come in at full intensity because the light's polarized at that point. So this looked like a promising way to capture that data. The problem is that we're only polarizing out one light source here. And that's telling us a little bit about the specular behavior where we're getting these highlights, but nothing in all these other areas where it's not reflecting, where the surface normal isn't reflecting the viewpoint into the light source. So we asked ourselves the question, can we actually polarize out more than one light source at a time? Can we, in fact, turn on our whole light stage, for example, and polarize every single one of these lights at some direction so that we can polarize out the specular reflection from the entire sphere of illumination at once, and then hopefully polarize it back in, take the difference, and see the entire specular channel reverse in space. So we basically started putting polarizers on the stage, and we found that if you put them in a particular pattern, which was actually a little swirlier than we thought it was going to be, we can actually pull that off. So basically, they kind of go in a little whirl around here. There's a singularity, which happens at something called the Brewster angle, which actually kind of disguises this effect here. And they're kind of vertical around here and vertical around here and horizontal on these other directions. So the result, then, is that we can actually put a person in the light stage, light them from every direction at the same time, and then take a photograph of them with absolutely no specular reflection coming from any part of their face. And this is actually a really nice kind of photograph to have, because you'll probably never see a person more flat-lit than this. If you're trying to develop, you know, the diffuse map for your video game character, this might be a really good image to start with, because it's basically the guy's diffuse albedo, maybe with a little bit of ambient occlusion baked in, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. If you then take the polarizer on the camera and turn it 90 degrees, we actually tune the specularity back in. So now we're with the specular reflection, and if we subtract the two images, we get this image. This is just the specular reflection. This is Tom, and this is just his specular reflection from the entire sphere of illumination directions at once. So if you're trying to develop like the spec map of your video game character, this might be a good image to start with as well. Again, it's polluted by reflection occlusion a little bit, but that's not necessarily a bad thing for real-time rendering. So at this point, we have a nice way of looking at just the specular light off of somebody's face. What we'd like to do is try to figure out the fine-grained surface detail of all the pores and wrinkles that are there. And to do that, we kind of like to do sort of a form of photometric stereo on this reflection so we can figure out a surface normal everywhere. And then if we get that detail, maybe we can add it into kind of a standard 3D scan and have something that has the correct global geometry plus the correct local geometry. So we found that if we do a couple other lighting conditions, not just full-on lighting, but actually gradients of illumination, a gradient with bright light at the top going down to 50% of the equator down to black at the bottom, and one that goes from right to left, and one that goes from front to back. If we take these different images here, it actually performs a form of spherical specular photometric stereo that gives us a normal map for the face. It's really as simple as just basically taking this top-lit image, dividing it by the full-lit image, and then that gives you the Y component of the surface normal based on the specular reflection. You can also do that with the diffuse component as well, using a slightly different form of map. But we found that the specular normal map that we get actually has a lot of great skin detail, whereas the diffuse normal map, if you kind of shade the face according to what we measured the diffuse normals, you get to see a little bit of detail like near the whiskers and things like that. But there's nothing compared to the kind of shading you can get off of the specular normal map, which all of a sudden has all of this nice skin detail to it. So the idea then, if we want to get this high-resolution scan of somebody's face, is we'll start with, like, you know, a video projector scan where we do gray code patterns or sine waves of different colors or something like that. That'll give us geometry based on the subsurface reflection that's maybe accurate to a millimeter or two, something like this. And then if we run these spherical photometric stereo patterns, There's not very many of these lighting conditions, so we can actually shoot them with a 12 megapixel digital camera in like about a second or so in burst mode. We can capture that data and then effectively emboss it onto the high resolution scan. And then all of a sudden, we're getting some of this nice skin detail back, which would otherwise be very difficult to get without analyzing the spectral reflections and without doing a face cast so that you have a version of the face in plaster that doesn't have any subsurface scattering. There's some recent work by Neham et al. In Sankar Shinkevich's group from Princeton that has this kind of technique that embosses this detail. We played around with it in the early light stage days as well with Jonathan Cohen on there. So there's good algorithms for this. What we can do then is if we have one of these relatively high resolution scans, something else that's a benefit over scanning a face cast is we actually have a perfectly aligned diffuse texture map to put onto our model, and we have a perfectly aligned specular intensity map. So we can in fact do relatively fast real-time renderings of the face with these good radiometrically calibrated maps. And in fact, this is a face rendering here. This is actually kind of a real-time rendering where we've done another thing, where we actually used to shade the specular component of the reflection, we're actually using the specular normal map, which in fact, in this case, is embossed onto the geometry. So we can just use the geometric normals. But for the diffuse reflection, we're actually using surface normals that were estimated off of the diffuse reflection of the face, the reflection that had gone through that scattering. And we actually found that the surface normal maps you get from diffuse light are a lot blurrier than the ones you get from specular light because of the scattering. In fact, the red one is the blurriest because that has the longest mean free path for that wavelength in skin. The blue is the sharpest, but still not nearly as blue as the specular map. But if you render with all four of those independent hybrid normals, you get something that's kind of a first order approximation to subsurface scattering simulation in just the local shading model. So we got some good results with that. We compared it to some offline subsurface scattering renderings here. This is done using, I think, Jensen and Bueller 2002, using Marcus Fajardo's Arnold renderer. And you get comparably nice results. So you can really use this data in either kind of a real-time pipeline or an offline pipeline. We also found it wasn't just good for faces. After scanning somebody's face, we thought, hey, why don't you just hold your hand up in there? And we got this image here. It really had a lot of great detail of the kind of the palm print there. The detail's everywhere. You really, again, only see it in the specular reflection in this rendering. But we used that to do both some real-time renderings using these hybrid normal maps. And we got a really nice one with the subsurface scattering simulation here. This digital hand data set that we got. I think the little bit of light bleed that you get across the shadow, which you wouldn't get just the normal mapping technique, really helps sell that effect a bit. So we're looking forward to hopefully capturing this data, getting more detailed BRDF information, because we actually don't get a spatially varying specular roughness parameter out of that. Some of our ongoing work is working on recovering that from a small number of lighting conditions as well. So let's see here. So I have one more thing to talk about. I think it's relatively quick. It's, let's see, on a bit of a different topic, but I'll be able to show you one of our data sets from earlier on in the talk, actually running on it. And it's something that we got to do for SIGGRAPH this year for the Emerging Technologies menu. And it's a 3D display that we had a chance to put together. This was a collaborative effort with Ian McDowell from Big Space Labs and Mark Bolas from the USC School of Cinematic Arts. We had a visitor from Sony Corporation, Kadesh Yamada, and our first author in our group was Andrew Jones. And this is a 3D display that produces a completely 3D autostereoscopic image. You don't need special glasses. You need relatively good eyesight because it's not a terribly large three-dimensional image there. It's just about maybe 13 or 14 centimeters high. But it's a 360-degree display, so any number of people can crowd anywhere around it and actually see a live 3D image. It's also interactively created, so these are not static holograms you have to upload to it, but you can actually manipulate the content in real time. And the way that this thing works is that there's a spinning mirror here at 45 degrees that reflects light from a video projector above it around to everybody standing around the display. And the video projector is running at very, very high frame rates. It started its life as a normal DMD DLP video projector, but the digital micro mirrors there have been hotwired to interpret the DVI signal to it in a sort of strange manner. In particular, Normally what you do is you send 24-bit color images over the DVI cable, and then it shows them as 24-bit color images, filter wheels and dithering and things like that. We wrote some, or built actually a custom FPGA that when it sees a 24-bit color image, it thinks of it as 24 1-bit images, and it actually plays them as a little 24-frame movie really quickly. With these NVIDIA cards that you've got these days, you can actually put the refresh rate up well above 60 hertz or 85 hertz, what we usually run our monitors at, to 180 hertz or 200 hertz. I'm not actually sure why they let you do that, but you can. And if you then, say, run your NVIDIA card at 200 hertz, and then for each one of those hertz, you're actually getting 24 images in there, you can actually project 4,800 frames per second, nice number, down onto the mirror. And then if the mirror is spinning around at like 15 or 20 times per second, you can actually put, you know, around 300-ish individual views of the scene all the way around in a circle and update that at 15 to 20 hertz. So that's how our display works. And this, if we're lucky, will actually play a little video. And this one here is not playing, so I'm going to pop up for a second. I'm going to find our video here. Cool. So here's our mirror, and it's gonna, this is before we start spinning it around in sync with the video projector. You can see the video projector image is kind of just a swirl. It has to rotate the image around really fast to keep up with the mirror. But once it synchronizes up, we can actually see a live 3D model on the display. And if you walk around it, there it is in 3D. Now, there's lots of kinds of 3D displays out there. One thing that helps distinguish ours a bit is that it's actually an occluding display. When we're looking at the back of the head, we don't see a ghostly image of the front of the head shining through, which you'd see, like, in, for example, volumetric displays that move diffuse surfaces through a volume so that they kind of glow all in all directions. Since we're actually showing independent views of the scene in all different directions, we can essentially have the scene be occluding or not, or you can even change the nature of the scene, depending on where you're looking at it from. So something that's cool is that, you know, right now these NVIDIA cards are designed to play, you know, Quake 12 or whatever is out there. And those games, you know, make full use of the fact they can render 6 million polygons per second. Well, if you need to render 5,000 frames per second, as long as you keep yourself down to around, you know, a couple thousand polygons, these graphics cards can keep up with it. So this is about a 2,000 polygon head. It's being generated live on the graphics card. We're setting the bit mask over and over to the different RGB planes. And Andrew Jones here is holding a Paulinus device and manipulating it around in real time. So we're trying to think of a video game we could play with this here. If anyone has suggestions, I'd be happy to hear about them. So another thing we thought, since it's interactive, is that if somehow magically the display knew how tall you were and where you were viewing from, or if you were standing on your tiptoes or not, it could actually interactively adjust the viewpoint so that you could simulate vertical parallax as well. Normally this is a horizontal parallax only display, but in this case here we're actually holding the Paulinus device up to the camera, and as we move it up and down, it's giving us the effect of looking at the object from above and below. So that's kind of an area of future work. So far, this is black and white, but we've had at least one semi-desperate attempt at color here, where we built a special mirror that had two different colors on two sides. And if we spun that around, simultaneously projecting on the orange and the cyan sides, we could get kind of a two-channel color effect here. It's actually kind of nice because it doubled the refresh rate of the display for anything that wasn't completely saturated, and that made it look even more like a solid image there. Obviously, the right way to do this is to use a free-chip DLP, and we had the Texas Instrument folks come by a couple weeks ago. They seemed to like it, so it might help set us up with one of those, we're hoping. So far, we just looked at raster graphics. We'd also like to be able to show some real-world imagery. So we showed that if we have like a light field of an object, this is a tourist souvenir, one of our lab members brought that out. We shot a light field of it on a turntable at a couple different levels. We showed we can show light fields on here as well. Use the real object and the version on the display. In this case here, we're using error diffusion dithering, actually Victor Ostromikov's dithering algorithm to simulate gray levels. This is a little bit of motion blur on the mirror and a little bit of diffusion on the anisotropic diffuser on there. It gives us a respectable amount of gray levels there. And then finally, we thought, well, it would be nice to show an animated data set. We didn't know how to get like our tourist souvenirs to actually animate. We thought, well, is there anything animated that we could like, you know, put on a little turntable and go on a camera? So, oh wait, we did that, right, okay, cool. So Bruce, who had not read all the fine print in his release form, called into service one more time. And here he is. So not quite Princess Leia in this case, but it's what we got. So that is everything I brought to talk about. Let me go to my last slide of the presentation here. I can briefly mention, but by the way, it's not just as simple as rendering different views of the scene all the way around. There's actually some weird multiple center of projection effects that result from the fact that once rays come out of the projector, they continue to diverge after they hit the mirror, so you're not actually rendering a particular frame for a particular viewpoint. They kind of get spread across a bunch of viewpoints. So the solution to that is actually to render somewhat strange-looking warped versions of the images that are essentially multiple center of projection renderings, where like the wings here kind of converge on each other in a weird way. And then by the time it hits the mirror and then gets out into the scene, it looks like a perspective view. So that's actually what a big part of the SIGGRAPH paper on that one is about. So there's some stereograms online if you want to take a look at this these things for yourself. If you're good at cross-fusing quickly, you might be able to get right and left together right here. If anyone's from Los Angeles, our institute is close just north of LAX Airport, and want to drop by, send us an email. Let's see here, there's a bunch of people to thank. Just obviously to work with a lot of different people over the years, and I've probably come up with most of them, I hope, here in the co-authors list. I want to thank Alyosha Akros and Penny Martin for setting up the visit. And I have a very limited number of DVDs of some of my early SIGGRAPH films that I had a chance to bring. I don't know if they're around over here. There's like about 20 of them, so there's not one for everyone. If anyone doesn't get one on their way up, then they're welcome to send me an email with DVD in the title, and we'll get one over to you. But anyway, thank you very much. It is definitely a three-dimensional effect. We actually have 288 views around in the circle, so if you're standing at about a meter and a half distance, there's actually six different views between your two eyes that you don't even see. So you definitely get different views to the left and right.
Are you going to sign the CD?
Let's see here. If anyone would like their signs, feel free to open it up, and I'll see if I've got anything that'll write up. Yeah.
I just had a technical point for somebody not in vision. I was under the impression if you were going to take that many pictures of that many different cameras, you'd have to hit them with a whole lot of photons, and it would get all sweaty. And is that not a problem?
Great question. I think you were sweaty because we had them running on the treadmill for 15 or so minutes. The total amount of light that we get in light stage 5 is 5,000 lux if we shoot it with a light meter, and in light stage 6 is 8,000 lux. We don't turn all the lights on at the same time, and they are, after all, just LEDs, the same ones they sell for like little flashlights and stuff. Outside on a sunny day, you're in about 180,000 lux. Outside on a typical, on a bright cloudy day, I think today's a dark cloudy day, I guess we're at about 2 or 3,000 lux out there, so we're probably twice that brightness. A bright cloudy day is about the kind of illumination that we have in there. It seems bright for two reasons, usually because you're in a dark room before we turn it on, and then it seems like it's pretty bright, and also because we've taken all the light of the environment and we've concentrated it into these little points, which means that when you actually look at a point, each individual point is, you know, 10 times or 100 times brighter than it would be otherwise. But it's not terribly uncomfortable. We try to run it at a rate so that the blinkiness isn't enough to upset anyone.
Is there any way to do a light stage on a low budget?
Great question. Great. Well, the first light stage, Light Stage 1, was built for almost exactly $1,000. And I didn't know if I was going to have any research funding at that point. I'm lingering postdoctoral researcher position at Dot Berkeley. So I did eventually get a paper from one of us in grant money, but I paid for that one myself. That was a relatively slow one, of course. There was a neat serigraph sketch this year by a Japanese group. I wish I could remember the university, but they did something where they were basically, they took a video projector and projected images onto a semi-transparent umbrella, opened up like this, and then the person stood here, and they could kind of generate incident illumination conditions over about maybe a quarter of the sphere or so. So it was kind of a curiosity, obviously a low-end solution for that. There's been a couple of neat aerographic scapes. I think Jack Tumlin was involved in one where they bought a motorized disco light that kind of, you know, put a beam, spotlight a beam anywhere with motorized lights, and they would trace that around inside a white room, and they would then photograph the reflection. It didn't produce all that much light once it actually arrived at the person's face, and there were some dynamic range issues because it tended to bounce light around the room, but they were able to get some useful light stage data sets that way. So there's been a couple of things, and there's probably ideas we haven't bothered yet that could improve that too.
So you do the static dynamic that determines the surface tunnels basis. Do you think you can get better results if you use some sort of like base paint or something that, you know, could alter, you know, like the properties of the things?
Excellent question, excellent question. Okay, well, one secret thing that we've done so far is actually is we've found that, like, really we want to film the specular reflection. To do that, we need to get rid of the diffuse reflection. So is there a way to make somebody's diffuse albedo go to zero without affecting or without eliminating the specular reflection? I actually found kind of a makeup that's actually a very thin coating of kind of a, I don't know, it's got some kind of flappers in it or something like that. It washes off or rubs on after a while at least. But we've done some shots where basically, you know, it's black, but it still has a specular shine to it. And that way, without having to do any polarization tricks, you can actually see the reflection of the illumination pretty effectively. So we're looking at that. We probably use something like maybe blue, and that way if you look at the red channel, it would basically be only specular light, and in the blue channel you'd actually get to see a diffuse reflection too, and you could find the albedo two different ways. The problem is we also like getting the diffuse texture map of the person's facial texture. So probably we'll continue to do polarization tricks so that we can observe both of them independently. But yeah, definitely good thought, and it does work.
You might want to consider painting up a high gloss oil-based paint. That also makes the specular stuff not much more. I believe that was what was done in the Bond movie with the gold thing.
Definitely,
and
yes. Very
cool. Look at that, and you'll see that heightens all of the stuff.
Very cool.
So this raises the issue that maybe you're not interested in truth in the sense of what is the actual shape, but in some sense you're willing to make errors or exaggerate so that later when you actually produce images that people look at, they're happy with what they see. Have you sort of pursued that sort of, you know, how can we heighten effects with various makeup or lighting or something?
It's a great thing to think about, and even though I don't think that's what we end up directly pursuing, we tend to directly pursue, you know, reality. Our goal is, you know, we want things to look good. One thing is that, you know, you might ask, why is it important to get high-resolution skin shape detail? Why do you want the shape of pores? Why do you want the shape of fine wrinkles? Well, the reason is that you can actually see them when you look at faces, and the place that you see them is mostly in the specular reflections. So you could actually say that we don't necessarily really need that high-res geometry of the face as long as we have some model of the face that's able to reflect light specularly in a way that's consistent with how the real face does. And that's kind of the basic idea of like normal mapping, for example. So we could definitely just leave our normals as a normal map and light them that way. There's some shapes that you're just never going to see well on a specular reflection because the face self-occludes, like the side of the nose. Just seen from the front, the specular light is just coming from the cheek, so it's not coming from our light stage. So we can't get a good specular map there. But it's very hard to excite a specular reflection from that part of the nose seen from the front. So even though we don't have it, you'd almost never see it, so we get away with it basically. So I think in many places throughout the talk, we're getting away with stuff because it looks right and the errors, you know, just don't end up showing. Image-based techniques tend to take advantage of that because we're starting with what can be sensed. modeling based on that and then generating new imagery, which ends up just happening to be consistent with what can be sensed, even if it's not consistent with what the real geometry or reflectance is in every perspective.
There did seem to be something screwy going on at the bottom of the crevices, like around the nostrils. It's too smooth.
I think in that case there, we're having a texture stretch issue because we're only filming from the front, and so we're kind of then rendering from the side a little bit, so you see that texture stretch. We're probably not getting the concavity behind the nose. So something we're doing in our light stage these days, we're trying to film from the front and from the sides as well, and then we can put all of the scans together and improve the quality there. But yeah, those are definitely artifacts we have so far.
All right, so Paul showed almost everything that I wanted to do in the show, except my favorite movie. So we are going to thank Paul, and those who need to leave, and that will show, I think, Paul's best short movie. It's only 3 minutes. So if for those of you who want to, please stay. And also, Paul will be available at the reception for a little bit at least. You can talk to him later. Okay, let's thank Paul.
This is a film that was done in 2004, and let's see, I think that is a quick time. And it's, I think, entirely computer generated. It's about the Parthenon. It's about the fact that the Parthenon sculptures are in the British Museum, and they're not on the Parthenon, and some people are concerned about that. And so it just kind of visualizes the sculptures in context. This is done with laser scans of the Parthenon, structured light scans of actually casts of the sculptures that are texture mapped. Photographs of the sculptures, some photometric stereo data sets of fine detailed inscriptions on the Parthenon as well. And then an illumination data set of time-lapse HDRI series of high dynamic range skies that are shot on the roof of our institute. They're illuminating the Parthenon, and all the reflectance properties and the texture maps of the Parthenon were derived using inverse global illumination techniques. There's only one real shot in the film, and that's this close-up of the sun rising, which is the sun rising outside our institute, and it goes on to full CG.